This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 389 for August 18th of 2017, FCA, PSA, and looking for a parking spot. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai.
All right, welcome everybody to another episode of Out of Line After Hours. Say a few syllables, Gary.
How are you guys doing? I was thinking about the show last night. Actually, I was at the Henry Ford Museum, and Craig Metros. Remember we had him on the show. He designed the Ford GT.
Right.
And he was there. They had an event where they House Industries, which is a graphic design house, and which was predicated on hot rods, because this is the Dream Cruise weekend, and so everyone who has a hot rod has to be somewhere the week before. So there was a number of them last night at the Henry Ford, and Craig had a hot rod, and it was interesting. There was a discussion with some of the graphic designers and Craig, and there was a 32 Ford that the father of the guy who had founded House Industries had made as a hot rod. And the person asking the question said, well, Craig, you know, if we look at that Ford GT, which is part of the exhibit, because they actually use House Industries fonts for the graphics on the car and in the gauges. And he goes, that car is anti-chrome. And you have a chrome vehicle out in the parking lot that's your hot rod. So it's sort of interesting to see that a guy who would, you know, have a chromed up hot rod would also have developed that car. Very interesting.
That's pretty cool. Well, we got to let everybody know who else is joining us on the show today. Joanne Muller from Forbes is here. Great having you here,
thank
Joanne.
Thank you. Good
and
to
be Dave Sullivan from Auto Pacific.
Yes, I'm back.
Great having you guys
thank
here.
You.
And this is going to just be a free-for-all discussion about all kinds of things going on in the industry. And, man, there is no shortage of things going on right now. And but, Joanne, one of the topics you suggested we talk about is NAFTA.
Well, yeah. So NAFTA, they've begun discussions this week on renegotiating
it. The auto industry has a lot of say as to what's going
on. They sure do, although maybe a little less after today. Strategy and Policy Board that President Trump had is disbanded. So Mary Barra, who might have had the presidency, or maybe not so much as much now. But at any rate, NAFTA's, you know, it's really important because, you know, obviously we've seen this huge migration of jobs and factories down to Mexico. There's a lot of debate over whether that would have happened without NAFTA. What can we do to straighten things out? There's a lot of, you know, the auto industry doesn't really want to change everything here because things are working fairly well for them. But there are some issues. Number one, I think they're very interested in currency manipulation. So they would like to see some stronger language, particularly against China, Japan, other countries, about currency. And then there's some tweaks. You know, they want to see environmental standards be the same, particularly across you know, Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., of course, you know, just trying to get more even playing field, but don't rock the boat too much.
Okay, you got to answer this for me.
Uh-oh.
Okay, you said currency manipulation, and then you mentioned countries that aren't Mexico or the U.S.
Yes.
Or
it's a very good point. Trade overall is a big issue, and, you know, President Trump wants to go and renegotiate all of these trade agreements. And he'd like to do each country one at a time because he thinks we're disadvantaged when we negotiate large treaties with multiple countries at once. So, at any rate, currency is a bigger issue for those other countries, in Asia in particular. Mexico and Canada, not so much. But there's plenty to talk about.
And there's plenty of talk, you know, other than automotive and NAFTA. I mean, there's a lot of other things to discuss, too. But, you know, for automotive, it kind of seems like a bit of a toss-up. Who is the power? Who's got the power in this negotiation? Is it the U.S. or Mexico? I mean, Mexico's growing. They have a great supply base. and they have negotiated free trade agreements with numerous countries to make them a much more attractive place to do business. So
true, but how much of Mexican exports come to the U.S.? It's huge.
Yes.
It's like what, 70%? I'm guessing something.
It's a significant amount.
Huge chunk.
But in terms of the, you know, they have all the control over the infrastructure that goes into a vehicle. You know, all of the parts. I mean, they have a lot of these things. And as an example, things that we won't do anymore in this country, and somebody might say object, but stitching the leather on a steering wheel, people won't do it here anymore. Right. It just is. And about 10 years ago, the last place in the U.S. that used to do that, they shipped it to Mexico. It's just one of those things that it's painful to do, and people here won't do it anymore. So there are things that, you know, that other people in other countries are happy to do, or maybe they're, you know, you can go down to an electronics plant in Mexico, and people are smaller. I mean, there's just things that are better done in other places. I mean, you know, people have smaller hands than we do, or whatever it may be. You know, so there are some things that make sense to do in other places.
Dave, is there the possibility from what you were saying before that that they've made treaties with other countries?
Yes.
That manufacturing could be done in Mexico for, say, Germany or China even, or wherever else, and that they could do very well, thank you very much, without.
Yes, that's what I was kind of getting at, was that Mexico, they have the parts, they have all the parts suppliers down there. And they have these negotiations where, you know, that they've had with other countries that have really made them a competitive place to assemble as well. And, yes, I mean, a lot of it might come to the U.S. now, but they have this capability. They got BMW investing down there. They've got, Toyota building another plant there. Audi just opened their plant. And that's, you know, supplying Q5s globally except for China, which I think might be knockdown kits or something for China only. But there's a... I mean,
Volkswagen, Nissan.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on down there. So I kind of wonder, could they really hold the U.S. to either drive vehicle prices up or whatever they might do, or they could, you know, if there were tariffs, they could really affect the competitiveness of the U.S. manufacturing base, where people.
Well, there was a really interesting development just in the past week or two when Mazda and Toyota announced that they are getting even closer. And what was key about that is that they're going to build a plant in the United States. Mazda is frankly screwed if they don't build that plant, because everything that Mazda now sells in the United States is imported. And they're one of the companies that is in trouble if these trade policies get much more restrictive. If there's a border adjustment tax, for instance, you know, they really are at risk, because, you know, they could get priced right out of the market. Mitsubishi.
But do you think there's going to be a border adjustment tax?
No,
or tariffs?
Probably. That sounds like it's dead, but yeah. Every once in a while it kicks up again. You know, at this point, I don't know what to expect out of the Washington, because it doesn't seem like any governing is getting done.
No. I would say that even if governing were to be being done, that NAFTA is a dead issue. I don't see any
NAFTA or
NAFTA, because
in terms of big changes.
The agricultural segment of the economy is so big.
Right, and that's what I was kind of getting at. People are like, I got to have my tomatoes in whatever month of the year you want to talk about, or strawberries or whatever. Yeah. And that's what I was talking about with, you know, yeah, we can talk about automotive, but, you know, NAFTA, there's a lot of other things
there. You know, the president may want this, but Congress has to ratify this. And I would suggest that there's sufficient lobbying on behalf of big ag that ain't happening. They're just going to say...
Retailers. I mean, there's all kinds
of... Yeah, it's... And so auto is... Yeah, it's... I mean, if we're in Detroit, we're all keen on that. But, you know, if you're... In Des Moines, it's, you know, it's all about corn.
I think Toyota and Mazda are going to come to regret this decision.
Mm.
I don't think Mazda could sell the product unless it cuts production in Japan or cuts production in Mexico. Dave, you're the sales analyst guy. I mean, do you see them needing this capacity at all?
No,
even Toyota.
It was a bit of a strain. You know, to say that you need two plants to build Corollas was...
That part was very confusing to me.
Yes, that's very confusing. Like, what are you seeing that nobody else is?
This is a total panic on the part of Toyota and Mazda.
Yeah.
Who look at Trump's tweets and go, oh, my God, we got to do something here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, tell them we're going to build a new plant. I think they're going to come, if the plant gets built, I think they're going to come to regret this decision.
No, and you know, to say that, okay, well, we're doing this and it's going to be a great benefit because we're going to make more Tacomas, more capacity for Tacomas. That's good, but why are we making more Corollas? I mean, not knocking the Corolla, but. You know,
it's a segment that's not selling.
It's a segment that's you know, by the time this plant comes online and production is ramped up, the segment's going to be
down. Look another decade and a half down the road, because when you build a plant, it's around for at least a half a century, at least, if everything goes well, right? So all this ride sharing, car sharing, are we going to need as many cars? And you got a chance to interview Carlos Tavares at PSA, is that right?
Yeah.
I saw your article.
Right. And spend some time in Paris trying to find out what he's up to.
What's he up to?
Well, you know.
Is that why you're really in Paris? Come on.
let's give him some kudos, first of all. He has very quickly turned
PSA around. Financially,
yes. And now he's taking on Opel, which he bought from GM, and he thinks he can do the same thing. You know, we'll see. The guy is very determined and very... He has some very well thought out plans as far as efficiency and so forth. But where it gets interesting is how he, you know, like everybody, he's trying to figure out how do we get into this mobility thing. And I think one thing that's very interesting about what they're doing that's different from some others is that they are looking at themselves as an aggregator of mobility. They're not necessarily trying to provide the mobility. They will provide the app that everyone else must have on their phone to get an Uber in New York or a Lyft in San Francisco or a Didi in China. And that, I think there might be a good market for that.
I think it's intriguing.
Who wants to have all those apps on your phone when you can just have one? And it will tell you which options you can use and what's the best way to go. It'll give you intermodal stuff. It'll also let you lease a car, finance a car. There's all this stuff. It's called Free to Move. It's just getting started, and they're going to use it here in the U.S.
So what's in it for them? I mean, so if John decides he's going to take a Lyft and Dave's taking an Uber and they use that app, what does PSA get?
Well, I mean, you know, they get a
skim right
very
off the top.
Small cut, but it's all about volume in this case, right? I mean, they need millions and millions of customers. But if you think about where the world is going, and if you think of it globally, maybe there are that many customers for them. The other thing that's really interesting about them is their U.S. strategy. I don't know if you've heard much about this. They want to come back.
Gary and I did an interview with Larry Dominique two shows ago.
No, it was last show.
Last show.
Yeah.
We were
okay.
Off for a week. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, last show we did.
And he mentioned the Free to Move.
Yeah.
And as being part of their strategy. And,
the idea is, you know, we got to get back into the U.S., but why should we build factories and dealers? Let's kind of find a way to connect with the customer first. And then if we want to import a few cars and put them in the fleet, you know, Peugeots or Citroëns, you know, gradually you can actually sell cars here again.
What do you think?
I mean, it seems like quite a lofty plan, but also, you know, to buy Opel, which has a lot of overlapping products for them, considering they already have two other brands. But I think it's an interesting idea, but the slices of the pie for the U.S. market have gotten so much smaller. I mean, look at like GM losing share, Ford losing share. It's getting harder and harder to make money here. So, you know, you hear about, like, Uber, how they were losing so much money leasing cars to drivers. You're like, what? I don't quite understand the economics of what they're trying to do in the U.S. yet. And it would be so easy. As I don't know if you've seen it, but on Google Maps now, you can, you know, type in a destination, and you can just hit a button, and it'll immediately order a car for you if you want.
Does it give you a choice?
But what I'm getting at is, what's to say that, you know, Google's agnostic on it and they say, well, you know, you can order an Uber, a Lyft, or whatever, you know, you would like just from, you know, here's what it's going to cost on all these different ones. I mean, they do it now with travel. They do it with other things. So I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it would be way too easy for somebody that's already well established and already on, you know, all phones to do something like that. So.
So, John, so we talked to Larry, and Larry is diligently looking at setting up infrastructure here and implying that they may do some things that would be slightly non-traditional, maybe not going all the way to the Tesla store in the shopping mall, but maybe not a traditional dealership. So do you think they're going to bring in a Citroen or a Peugeot or a DS? What will it be? And how well will they perform?
Well, my guess is it's not going to be DS. DS is not performing the way that they thought it would be. So, you know, my guess would be probably not Citroën either. You know, I think Peugeot, you know, the company is Peugeot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my guess is they're going to bring the Peugeot brand. But even at that, it's going to take time to get this thing
going.
I have
a Peugeot.
Do you have a Peugeot?
Peugeot salt and pepper shaker.
Oh.
They still make them. It's still part of the family biz, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There you go.
Hey, we've got to take a quick break. We got plenty more to talk about, but right now we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back talking about all kinds of things. Before the show started, we were talking a little bit about these fumes coming into Ford Explorers that several police departments have been complaining about.
Allegedly.
And allegedly, right. Now, we actually got a phone call about that. Let's bring that in right now.
This is Clem Zarovsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. In regard to the fumes in the Ford police cars, I used my Silverado pickup truck one time to gas to death a skunk I caught live. I put him in a cardboard box, cut some holes in the cardboard box, put it up against the exhaust pipe of the truck. Of course, I left the engine running. After the skunk passed away, I get back in my truck to shut it off. The smell of the skunk had been sucked in through the heater system, and the whole inside of the cab smelled like a skunk. So I'm wondering if these people are the police sitting idling and the wind's blowing in the right direction, it would blow the exhaust fumes around towards the front of the vehicle and be sucked in by the HVA system. Thank you.
Yeah, that's the police do spend a lot of time idling, and maybe that's one way that this stuff is getting into their vehicle.
Yeah, they claim that I think it was from like a grommet or something that was missing in the back near one of the lights, the like strobe lights that they have in the lift gate, or tailgate, and they think that's how it was getting in. But it seems like to fill up a whole cabin and, you know, knock somebody out. You'd need a lot more than
this. I hope that's the real reason, and I hope that's all it takes to fix it.
I hope
so.
But
we shall see. Hey, another thing that, getting back to another topic here that everybody in the industry is talking about right now, are the Chinese or some Chinese car company going to buy FCA? Joanne, what do you think?
Well, I have no particular inside knowledge, but I certainly know that they were very hot in talks with several Chinese companies a few years ago, before the Fiat folks came into the picture. So I think that, you know, it's quite possible. I think it's only a matter of time before some Chinese company is partnered with somebody. FCA is the one that has been very clearly for sale.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. I don't know.
You think Chinese companies were talking about buying the company formerly known as Chrysler?
Yeah, there were a lot of talks. Tom Lasorda was big into that. He was very, very close, from what I hear, to a deal with Geely at the time. Didn't happen. And I believe, didn't Geely just say, like, in the last couple of days, they were not interested?
Yes.
Well, if you look at the actual quote that I read that was reported, it says, "We have no interest in this whatsoever at this time."
So you mean tomorrow?
At this
tomorrow
price.
It might change.
Yeah, so what do you think, Dave?
At this price. I mean, for about the last 2 years when we've kind of heard about, you know, the product lineup changing, you know, getting rid of, you know, I'll backtrack a little bit. Think about how Marconi was all about, you know, wanting to get hitched with GM. And at the time, I mean, there was a lot of product overlap. The company, you know, had some products that weren't selling. So they needed to, you know, they weren't marriage material. So Marchionne took the company into the gym. He's cut a lot of fat out. He has, you know, been training. And, you know, I think he's getting the company back on the market. You know, Volkswagen still, they weren't interested either. So after you cut out the fat, the things that are losing money, Dart, 200, they're not selling. You know, the Compass and Patriot were both, you know, they're big fleet business. So, you know, they told us that, you know, Jeep sales are going to go down because, you know, we got this new Jeep that's going to replace these other two that are just terrible. And, you know, they're doing a lot of things, and they've grown tremendously in China, invested a lot of money. And then they're pouring a lot of money into everything that makes money. You know, Ram, supposedly bringing this Wagoneer and Grand Wagoneer. And, you know, they're trying to make the company look like, you know, it's for sale. So it's everything you would want, you know, the things that make money. So after the things with GM fell apart, or not fell apart, but were, you know.
Dead on arrival.
Dead, yes. you know, you start to think about it. Well, who else is there? I mean, and where is their money to buy a company like this today? It's not like you're buying it at the bottom when, you know, in bankruptcy where the company is basically handed to you. These guys want to sell it. And you know, that's and so you look at who's buying, you know. You have Proton and Lotus that were both bought recently. And, you know, and it's the Chinese. They're buying these companies up. You look around Detroit, it's, you know, similar story. I mean, they used to be laughed at for their cars, and now they're buying suppliers up.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of suppliers. And it, you know, they got laughed at, and now they're coming back, and they're going, we own the suppliers, and now we're going to get into the established, you know, we got distribution system here. You know, FCA looks like a great place to be because you got dealers who, like, what is there left of Chrysler? Yeah, 300 and a Pacifica. I mean, there's a lot of question marks about what's going on there. So
what do they get? They get Jeep and Ram basically then.
Maserati and Alfa.
Oh, maybe. But I heard maybe those stay.
Those
might not be for sale.
I don't think that's going to happen. You know, I was reading the analyst remarks that they had for the second quarter stuff, and what Marchionne was talking about is that, you know. Yeah, they've talked about bundling Alfa and Maserati and spinning them off. But could they then fund all the electrification and autonomous and other technologies? No, they're not going to have the money to do it. And if you do spin them off and you spin off Jeep and Ram, they call what's left over the stump. What do you do with the stump? And it's not going to survive. So I'm thinking we're going to see either a totally new structure to the company, i.e., maybe you spin off Maserati and Alfa, but FCA retains majority ownership of it. So it still allows investors to invest in a growing and profitable mm-hmm. part of the company. Same with Ram and Jeep. And now you can take that money and
but, or they sell, you know, they keep, you know, like the, you know, whoever would own whatever the Agnelli family, whatever they can own, if they owned, you know, Alfa and Maserati still, and they kept a minority ownership stake in whatever the new Chrysler would be. You know, they could maybe theoretically get some shared engineering resources or something right. for, you know, they can negotiate all those things. I mean, everything's on the table. But when you look at who is buying and investing in the auto industry today, it's the Chinese brands. They're the ones that are on the making the big push.
They want to grow, and boy, if you bought FCA, you'd have an instant large footprint in Europe and the Americas.
Okay, so but this leads us back to where we were talking about NAFTA. What is the political climate for a Chinese company to come to the United States and
Depends.
Buy what is still perceived by many people to still be a U.S. company?
It depends. I think. I mean, if you're going to come in and promise investment. And money that's spent, I mean, just look at what the Foxconn investment, mm-hmm. You know, that was a you know, big news for the Trump administration. So, I mean, if somebody came in and had the same kind of thing, you know, for
as long FCA, as they're going to create some jobs here, I think Trump would be all over that.
Preserve jobs.
Yeah.
But what I've been told by people in the industry is that the U.S. government would likely not approve a Chinese state-owned automaker buying FCA. So a Guangzhou, for example, already builds a bunch of Chrysler products in China. That's FCA's partner in China, but they're owned by the state. And so what I've been told is if it's going to be a Chinese company, to get U.S. government approval, it's going to have to be an independent, like a Geely, a Great Wall, Chery, somebody like that.
Remember they, about 10 years ago, they were promising they were going to bring a Chery car here. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're going to bring Chery cars here and sell them it as a Dodge.
Well, remember, that was Malcolm Bricklin.
Yeah.
That was trying, and, you know, he's the biggest huckster that came down the pike. So you got to take stuff like that with a grain of salt.
You know, I always thought that Volkswagen was the perfect pair for FCA until the diesel thing blew up. And now, you know, Volkswagen is, you know, financially and engineering-wise, they're just extremely distracted. So I don't see that happening again. Yeah. But, boy, I thought that was a way for Volkswagen, clearly, to get bigger here and the Chrysler products to get bigger in China.
Okay, yeah. So what happens if, and you were speculating about this, if Sergio, when Sergio retires, so you have new leadership, is it still going to be on the table? Or would the new guy say, I'm going to be like Carlos Tavares, I'm going to turn it around?
I don't think it matters because Exor is the... You know, the holding company that pulls the strings on what happens.
But Exor, I believe, made a decision about 5 to 7 years ago. We want out of anything industrial. Just get out of it. Ferrari will keep. That's a different situation. Massive margins, huge growth potential, not, you know, tons of capital investment. I think Exor or the Agnelli family has said, Sergio, you sell the company, and there's this big pot of gold for you. You know, big pot. If you don't sell it, okay, we'll give you a nice severance and retirement. But if you sell this company and get us out of this industrial thing called
Fiat Chrysler, buy some new sweaters.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so now he's got $4.5 billion in debt left that he's got to pay off. I think they're going to dump Magneti Marelli any day now, any day now. Texid, their casting company, Comau, their assembly equipment. I'm sure they're on the for sale block too. They've paid down their debt to the tune of $1 billion out of cash flow in the last year, which is pretty impressive. So if you can pay down that debt, there's a lot of money that could fall to the bottom line, making them even more attractive. But I think everybody seems to recognize they can't go it alone. No. Even a company as big as they are, 6 million vehicles a year globally, cannot go it alone.
And I think a lot of those little companies that they own, I mean, not little, but some of the, you know...
Tertiary.
Yes, they, you know, they might be great negotiating things, you know.
You mean the Magneti Marelli? Yeah. Like, no, I think his goal is sell it, take the cash, pay down the debt, get this thing ready
to
sell.
Maybe, and you know, you look at, like, KUKA, the
robot company.
I mean, it's Chinese now. I mean, it's just, it just keeps going. So I mean, if they're not in China to sell the whole company, they're in there to sell their other assets. So yeah, it's coming. But if you look at it, there's nobody else who wants to get into automotive that has the kind of resources that Chinese do. And also, I'd also say that it could be a non-automotive company that buys them. You know, Chinese company that wants to get into automotive that's not in automotive yet. You don't know. I mean, think about how much money, you know, you could be, you know, that's where these, you know, Lucids are going or, you know.
A Chinese Cerberus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So a year from now, is it sold or are we still talking about, who's going to buy FCA?
You'll know by next year.
What do you think?
I think it'll happen before Sergio retires, and he's retiring in 2018, so,
yes.
Right?
You'll know next year at this time.
Yep, I think so, too.
They announce in April-ish. The plan right now is to announce their next five-year plan. This is going to be Sergio's swan song. Right now, it's targeted in the April time frame to do this. I also believe he'll announce his replacement at that time. That's just my guess. So that the whole organization knows months in advance. Yeah, because he's going to retire at the end of December 2018. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it'll be sold yet.
This five-year plan will be the sales brochure for, you know, that's essentially what we're going to, you know,
I think you got to have a plan A and plan B. And plan A might be, sell it. If the Chinese want to buy it, fine. But plan B's got to be, what if it can't go through? What do you do? And how do you, you know, and if it's not being sold, Exor is still on the hook for this thing. And that's where I think they may present a plan of completely restructuring the company. And this is my thinking. This isn't anybody else telling me this stuff. But I wonder if you don't, like I said before, let you buy stock in Alfa and Maserati, let you buy stock in Jeep and Ram, and you can still buy stock in FCA, which will, you know, be the beneficiary of their growth. But how do you unlock shareholder value? And I think they're studying that right now. How can you restructure this company so that you get a much better stock price?
Okay, 2 years from now, can one of our viewers go to a Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram store?
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there'll be no change.
Well, can you still buy a Wrangler? Of course.
But can you buy a Dodge or a Chrysler?
Pacifica, yes.
It might just be a Pacifica.
But it might just be a Pacifica.
Yeah.
So you'd have a whole brand for one car?
It might just be a Pacifica.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Very possibly.
What do you think, Joanne?
I think things move slowly in this industry when it comes especially to dealers and brands. So I say, you know, you may be on to something. You may have a good idea there, but it's going to take a while for anything to happen.
There's, you know, you look at like Lincoln Company.
Right.
And, you know, PSA.
You mean the Chinese one, Lincoln Co.
Yeah, Link and Co. Yes.
Yeah. Not the Lincoln Motor Company.
Right. Link and Co. There's people who want to sell cars here still. And, you know, I think from what I've heard, Volvo dealers have pretty much shunned the idea of selling those. So you got to start thinking outside the box how you can, you know, Chrysler doesn't have any 300 left. You know, yeah. Well, it's got to start thinking some outside the box a little bit. And it's a big country and we like to drive. So you need infrastructure to sell cars. So who knows?
Okay, we got to take another quick break right now. We're going to come back to Dr. Data. We've got a bunch of questions from the audience that we ought to get to and other topics, but right now we're going to give a shout out to our friends at Hyundai. Okay, we're back, and this is the part of the show where we got to bring Dr. Data up on stage.
All right, Dave just mentioned this is a big country, and we like to drive. So, Carmen, please bring up the first slide. So this is something that has to do with driving for 17 hours per year.
Time wasted in traffic per driver.
That's got to be more than that. 17 hours?
And this is just the United States.
Time spent fueling?
Ah, that's a good one. No?
John was the closest.
Really? Mm,
okay.
The amount of time wasted looking for a parking space.
Ah,
in the United States.
Mm.
So 3.6 billion total hours. This is according to INREX. And they calculate that's 1.7 billion gallons of fuel is wasted by people driving around looking for parking spaces. So in New York City, they estimate that it's 107 hours a year for someone to be driving around looking for a parking space. And then it's...
I'm not sure I buy this.
I wouldn't drive there unless I knew I had a spot, so...
But that's because you live here. If you live there, you have no choice, right? They're saying L.A.'s 85 hours.
You'd have to rent one.
No, Detroit's 35 hours. Detroit's in the top 10, by the way, so I just want you to know that.
I'm not sure. You know, INREX has got an interest in selling this story, you know, because they're selling, we got the technology to find you a parking spot. I don't spend 17 hours.
That's what PSA needs in their app, find a parking spot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Waze,
that's exactly the kind of stuff
Waze has Waze is working
spot.
On. Yeah.
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 Hey, a couple of questions here we got from the audience. Paul Wicklin says, I'll throw this to you, Dave. Why doesn't Hyundai just buy FCA and get trucks and make Genesis and Chrysler?
Wow. I mean, yeah, it sounds great.
Would Hyundai? I mean, we talked about the Chinese. What about Hyundai?
I I would have 10 years ago, maybe. They seem to be more cowboy style and freewheeling, but they've really dialed back. And, yeah, I mean, in terms of, like, a company that still is, you know, into steel and everything else, yes, I mean, they seem like a great fit. You know, Hyundai also is really into their, you know, they love to have, commercial business. Like, they have a new commercial van lineup in Europe. You know, they'd love to grow here. They seem to still think we like sedans a lot, and that's starting to burn their share that they've grown over the years. So I mean, yeah, it makes sense, but I don't think they're in any position to make that kind of purchase at the moment. That's not, you know, they might, but they would be a logical fit, just very sedan-centric lineup with a, you know, pickup truck that they've, you know, back to the John Krafcek days, he was always, you know, oh, we need a pickup truck. That could be it. But it's to have that control of a company of that size not be in Korea, I think could be a bit of an issue.
It's sort of interesting you think about it. I mean, so Hyundai is the fifth largest automobile manufacturer in the world. And yet, you know, until this question, that didn't even occur to me. So, you know, we're all thinking of the Chinese, and this actually could be
Hyundai has hit a bit of a lull in terms of their market share globally, and haven't really understood what their comeback is going to be. They've lost quite a bit of share this year.
Not just in the U.S.?
No, and then globally. I mean, I think globally their sales are down like 8% or something this year. So, you know, and Hyundai and Kia, you know, I think they own, 40% of Kia. And, you know, these vehicles are all on top of each other that they sell. They, you know, same warranties, the same powertrains. So you got a Sonata and an Optima, and all these vehicles are on top of each other, and they have too many. So they'd have to do a lot of cleaning themselves, I think, to, you know, trim their own lineups to make something like that happen.
They ought to join the same gym as
Chrysler.
Getting buff.
Exactly.
Okay, Jeffrey Rainey, I hope I got that right, has got a question about Peugeot. You just talked to Carlos Tavares. He wants to, do they still make bicycles?
Yes, absolutely.
There
they
you
do.
Go.
And salt
yes.
pickers.
Yep. Yeah.
And he says he's still puzzled why FCA, at least on paper, separated Ram and Viper from Dodge.
I mean, I think the whole reason was to silo the brands in order to pair them off eventually. I mean, that was part of the reason. So, but, you know, at the same time, they had also said Chrysler was going to be the mainstream brand for them. That was going to be their Ford or Chevy. And that hasn't happened either. So,
yeah.
But, yeah, I think the whole reason was, okay, you want Ram? Well, we already have this brand here for you. It's not part of Dodge. So I think that was part of the whole reason why that was done.
Okay, RLH Marine says, and I'll throw this to you, Dave. Ask your guest about any rumors of the 2019 half-ton truck diesel engines that GM will debut in its next generation trucks.
What about them? I mean, they're supposedly coming. I know Johan has confirmed that there are basically said there were two diesels coming to Cadillac by around the turn of the decade. And I know one of them is going in the trucks, but with FCA and Ford both having a diesel in their truck, GM can't not have one. So I'm pretty sure it's coming. The topic of discussion is the displacement. You know, if the Silverado is so light that you know, could they go to a four-cylinder diesel? In the Silverado, if it's really that much lighter than what they're, you know, from what I'm hearing, could it be a four cylinder diesel? You know, the Colorado diesel, it could be the, you know, that was a 2.8. I think it's, I mean, that could be it. I don't know, but you know, there's a old 4.5 liter diesel from 10 years ago that was shelved and
right.
I don't think that's too much. So,
okay, and one last one. Gary, Bob Wilson says, ever since the first Prius in 2001, they've had higher city mileage than highway. Yet no diesel has ever come close to that kind of city mileage. He wants to know, will diesels ever crack the city mileage barrier without being a hybrid?
Well, I mean, fundamentally, when Toyota created the Prius was to be a city car, to drive in the cities, because if you ever drive in Tokyo, I mean, it's just traffic jams, and you probably spend more than 107 hours looking for a parking spot. But be that as it may, you have regenerative braking, and that's why when you're basically driving a hybrid at highway speeds, you know, you have no greater efficiency. You're running off the internal combustion engine. So that's why diesels do so well driving on the highway, and when you get into the city, there's not that advantage. So it's highly unlikely that you'd have a situation where that would happen. But, you know, this sort of, you know, segues into the question of diesels for pass cars. So the Equinox diesel number came out this week for highway driving, speaking of that, 39 miles per gallon highway from a 1.6 liter turbo diesel engine.
With a 6-speed automatic, not their new 9-speed.
So do you think they have a possibility of selling very many Equinox diesels?
Probably not. We don't really expect there to be a high take rate for it. Of course, there'll be some people who want, their commuter. I mean, and that's, you know, they need to be able to put their kids in the back and that kind of thing. And so there's definitely some buyer for it. But starting around, 2020, 2021, I expect to see the diesel choices really disappear. I don't know if the Equinox will, outlast this, but the emissions changes that are coming are going to make this stuff so expensive that it will just not make the sense to do it anymore.
Why is GM still, pushing out diesels when everyone else seems to be running the other direction?
Ford is adding one. But,
yeah. But, Ford isn't talking about doing it for pass cars.
Passenger cars and crossovers.
Yeah, and the thing is, I was looking at the numbers for the Equinox other powertrains, and it's very curious to me. So for the turbo diesel, it gets 137 horsepower and 240 foot-pounds of torque, right? Okay, so you can get a 2-liter, and it has 252 horsepower and 260 foot-pounds of torque. And it's fuel economy, front wheel drive, not bad, 2229. It's certainly not 39, but or you can get a 1.5 liter, you get 170 horsepower, 203 foot-pounds of torque, and you get 2632. I don't see the advantage of the diesel.
No, the gap has been closed. I mean, it's really closed.
Right.
But I think it's a bit of a stopgap until they can get a hybrid lineup and, put in their crossovers and cars. So it's just they have the Malibu hybrid, but nobody's buying Malibus. So now you got to and this was planned a lot a while ago. They have this, they developed all these engines in Europe, in Italy. And
the diesels.
Yeah, and I think there might have been maybe they had to put them somewhere, and they knew they were, they shopping Opel, and they had to do something with this. So, but I think it's also a bit of a stopgap till hybrids are in the plan for crossovers. So,
Joanne, do you think that people will buy diesel passenger cars of any sort in the United States?
I don't really see a big market for it. I mean, for a while I thought that people were beginning to accept them. But I think this Volkswagen thing and all the fallout with every manufacturer since then has just made people skeptical. And as you point out, the regular gasoline engines are so much better. There's a lot of plug-in hybrids coming, largely, regulatory driven. But I'm beginning to see a plug-in hybrid as my choice.
Pretty much the sweet spot.
Yeah.
When you look at a diesel, there are so many things that can go wrong now with I know somebody who just had replaced, they got a, I won't say the brand, but they have a diesel European car, and the DEF tank heater has died again. And, it's $3,000.
What is that?
Oh, this is the diesel exhaust fluid heater. It heats the DEF urea, the urea system. It eats
the tank.
It has to be
heated before it can.
Yeah, so in the, so it doesn't freeze in the winter.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that they can suck it, it can get sucked up and injected into the exhaust. But this heater has died twice. It's $3,000.
Is that under warranty?
The first one was. The second one was not. So.
So there's a lot of complexity in that, what I hear, right? And then you think about an electric powertrain, it's a pretty simple thing, right? I mean, if we can master the battery thing and you know, the electronic systems are improving, everybody's investing heavily in new electronic architectures, you know, it seems to me the momentum is definitely in that direction. I mean, right now we're not seeing it. The sales are not really anything to write home about. But I just think when I look at what's in the pipeline and what they're putting their engineering resources into, diesel just, it seems to me like the wrong direction.
For a pass car, for sure, I'd agree.
Yeah.
You know, if you get into trucks and SUVs, it might be a different situation.
Yeah.
Because they may not lend themselves to electrification as easily.
Well, I mean, you look at, like, you know, Ford has said they're bringing, you know, hybrid F-150 and they have a diesel. And so, I mean, there's, you know, whether you're, if you're driving an F-150 on the freeway, that, yeah, we got one for you. If you want to drive an F-150 in the city, we got one for you. Kind of taking away any excuse why you wouldn't want to buy one.
But we don't have a parking space for you in the city.
Yeah, they're going to be on the app, though. So John, when we were talking to Robert Davis in Traverse City, and that was on the show for those who didn't see it, he was talking about all of the headroom in terms of improving internal combustion engines, and
right.
that he seemed to indicate that, so far as Mazda was concerned, that electrification was not a big deal.
Yeah.
Of course, then 2 or 3 days later, they made that announcement with Toyota, which sort of like put the kibosh to that. But
right.
So, I mean, do you think that it's not a choice between a diesel or a hybrid? It also could be a choice between a diesel, a hybrid, or an internal combustion engine, just straight up?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot more life left to the internal combustion engine. You know, Mazda made this announcement of HCCI. Robert, who's with Mazda, told us they see another 30% improvement coming. And, you know, as I've been preaching all along, you know, the problem isn't the engines when it comes to emissions and carbon emissions. The problem's the fuel. And it's time for the oil companies to step up. Mm-hmm. And GM and Ford have publicly called for higher octane gasoline. And the EPA and the California Air Resources Board are calling for decarbonized gasoline, where you take anywhere from 10 to 30% of the carbon out of gasoline. We already have PZEV emission level internal combustion engines that from an emissions standpoint can match what a pure battery electric does when you blend in where the sources of electricity are coming from. So I think if the CARB and the EPA were truly to be agnostic and just say, we don't care how you do it, we just want you to get down to this emissions level, we're not going to incentivize electrics or hydrogen or any of that. You guys just figure out how to do it. I think it can be done with an internal combustion engine.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, if the octane ratings increase, that opens up a whole new set of things that can be done.
You can downsize engines even more.
Yes, even more than we have now. And, you know, we have issues now. Like Mercedes-Benz is adding particulate filters to gasoline vehicles here. And, you know, there's a lot of things that are coming that are going to continue to extend the life of these vehicles to meet standards. So there's a lot of innovation that's happening now. Yeah, the whip has been cracked, and now things are starting to happen. But, the octane rating is a big thing. That's a big reason why we haven't seen even more downsizing happen. The carbon issue is also another issue. But I think if you see the EPA in the next 2 years – you know, who knows what will happen with this administration, but if the octane ratings change, the gasoline engine's going to get another lease on life.
Yeah. Hey, look, we got to take another quick break. This is a good topic. We got to come back to it. But right now, we got to give a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking about all kinds of things automotive. Gary, I'm scanning the questions that have come in from the audience here. Alexander wants to know, how has the Fiat brand performed in the U.S. market this year sales-wise? And does the brand have a future in this market?
Let's see. I think that if I had paid all the money to buy and equip a Fiat studio, we don't call them dealerships there, studios, I'd be very upset because those cars are going nowhere. But this sort of gets back to the point of when we were talking earlier, maybe it was before the show started, about, you know, small cars. And Dave, mm-hmm. you're talking about Fiesta, Ford mm-hmm. Fiesta. And so, I mean, if you look at the showroom of Fiat, I mean, even the 500L is still a small car, right? And so if people are not buying small cars, then what are they going to do?
No, right? They are buying small cars. They're just buying the crossovers.
So
look at the Renegade and the 500X.
Right.
They're just not buying the Fiat.
Okay. Because it looks like a crossover vehicle.
Yeah, right? And the 500X looks like...
But, I mean, in terms of the future, I mean, that's predicated, I think, goes back to the conversation about if they get sold to a company.
There's so many extra brands in this industry, right? And you could make a list. Would you really miss Fiat if they were gone? Would you really miss Mitsubishi?
No.
You know, I mean...
It's funny you mention that, Joanne, because I just added this all up. There are 15 OEMs in the U.S. market with 36 brands, 310 different models. And when I say different models, I'm not saying like, I'm counting, for example, the Mustang as one model.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not the GT, not the turbo, not mm-hmm. the convertible. And so if you look at the trim lines, there's multiples, thousands of them.
Oh, yeah.
And does the consumer need that much choice? No. Does the market need that much choice? No. And if you believe markets are rational, that's right. going to get... And in fact, I think I counted, I want to say either 21 or 28 models that this time next year will be gone. So I think the process is starting.
Did you count any brands that would be gone?
No, I just looked at cars that I know for an absolute fact that are going away.
No predictions.
No. Okay. This is not prediction.
Yeah.
This is fact.
Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah. Well, and if you believe that we're moving toward shared rides, you don't really care what brand of vehicle you're getting into when you push that app. And, you know, so the brands are...
Do you really... I mean, I know this might sound... I'm just going to play devil's advocate for
sure.
But do you really think there are going to be... We're all just going to share a ride?
Not we all, but in places like... Well, San Francisco, yes. New yes. York, Chicago, yes. L.A.
Where there is 107 hours.
Where you don't have to spend the 107 hours, right. But right. My point is, like, you know, you think about, you got disabled people, you have people with kids and, you know, car seats and other things. You know, these are...
You're saying disabled people with wheelchairs
like or
that.
Whatever, some sort of special need
right.
that, you know, have a, whatever, they can only get into a certain type of car or... You know.
Yeah, but think about all those other disabled people who can't go anywhere,
right. yes.
who are blind or whatever, and this is opening
yes,
up all
of
kinds
course.
Of things.
And, but I'm kind of getting it like, you know, I have three children. Am I going to get, you know, wherever I go, am I going to take three car seats out every time I...
No.
But
here's the
craziness.
Point, Dave. I agree with you. Not all of us are going to share cars. Not all of us are going to get autonomous cars. But even if only 10%... of the new car buying public says, you know what? I'm just going to Uber it. I'm going to Lyft it wherever I want to go. It cripples the industry. You know, you're talking about taking, you know, based on last year's sales, you know, 1.75 million vehicles out of the market. And that's where you start to see the Mitsubishis and others
yeah.
disappear.
Okay, so but the asterisk on that is that those fleets of shared cars are on the road longer, so they get replaced faster. So the production, I don't see like a huge hit in production.
I do, and here's why. Because you're looking at today's cars, and are they going to last? No, they're not. But I believe as we get into ride sharing, fleets are going to manage this. And the first thing they're going to say is, I don't want a car that was designed to last 150,000 miles. I want a car that's going to last 1 million miles.
And I don't care what brand it is. Right. I want it to have, you know, four seats and a bunch of USB.
London taxi
plug.
Cab
yes.
is the best example.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And so you don't worry about what's the residual value. You don't worry about annual styling changes. You
right.
It's
right.
like, no, it's this black box that's very roomy and gets me yes. where I want to go. So I don't buy the argument that's been made that, oh, these cars are going to run out, so, wear out so fast, we'll replace them much more quickly. We're going to design them to last a million miles.
Okay, so let's bring it back to Peugeot for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
This is exactly what they see as an opportunity. They don't care. They're investing in their brands, but they also know somebody has to make those cars that all these fleets are going to use. And they, in particular, see cities putting up small, efficient factories to make their own cars and, you know, turn them out. They also would see, in countries where you're limited to, you know, you have to have localized manufacturing. They see this opportunity to build these small micro factories. Point is, they see that they can sell a bubble car, a generic cheap car. If they can get efficiencies out of their factories, they can make cars cheaper. They can afford to sell them no-name cars.
Then why'd they buy Opel?
Because Germans don't like French cars.
Yes.
That's why.
So,
and he's made no bones about that. Hmm. He fully admits it. He says, I don't agree with it, but Germans don't like our cars.
So, I mean, this also gets back to the point of why somebody would buy FCA if there's the possibility that this gets, you know, the market takes a big hit because of car sharing.
Yeah.
Now, you'd say, okay, people are still going to have pickup trucks because you still... you know, work and put stuff in the back of your pickup trucks. There's probably still going to be Jeeps because people like to...
I will be the last person that gives up a car for...
Will peel your...
Yes.
Cold dead fingers off it, right.
Sorry.
But so, I mean, what's the advantage of getting into the car industry right now if we're on the precipice of the cliff?
Because FCA has some highly desirable products. And, you know, even if you owned it for 10 or 15 years...
Mm-hmm.
You could maybe make some money on it.
Okay, then why does Peugeot come to the United States?
Well, I think they, you know, obviously they want to make money like everybody else. They're trying to find a different way to make money. But I don't think they're going to be selling a lot of Peugeots here.
No.
I think they're going to be selling a lot of services here.
You know, because I was thinking what, you know, you're saying earlier, Dave, that, you know, you got to think outside the box somewhat in terms of what's going on in this industry when you're talking about those child seats in the back mm-hmm. of your car. And so Maven, which is the General Motors ride hailing sharing
mm-hmm.
Business, opened up their gig part of their company. And I was reading about one of the companies they're working with, and it's like an Uber or a Lyft, but it's for parents to take their children and put them in cars, and the people who are driving these cars have been completely vetted and
fingerprinted
and I would imagine that there could be situations where there would be people who would basically would have child seats in their cars to come, you know, that's their purpose, right?
Yep.
I mean, and so suddenly that argument goes away because, you know, it's not necessarily your car because you're going to be driving it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, but nobody's thought about, you know, peak times, you know, oh, we're all going to share, and then how are we all going to get home at the same time or all get to work at the same time, and then what are all these cars going to do in the off-peak time? I mean, nobody's, yeah, I don't know, I haven't really heard anybody come up with any good ideas for things like that.
That'll get figured out. That'll get figured out, and it'll grow slowly because of, you know, there's going to be a steep learning curve on how you do this on scale. But I think it can be solved, and this is why I believe dealers are going to play a great role in this, because I think you're going to have acres to park these cars on when they're not on use. You're going to have a string of service bays to keep them up and running, and dealers have all that, and dealers are in every single community.
Yeah, but car sitting down, not moving, is not making any money either, so...
That, I don't think, will be so much the dealer's worry. It's going to be the fleet manager's worry of how do we... have this asset earning money,
mm-hmm.
but I could see these fleets saying, why should I invest in all this real estate and all these service bays when they're already out there right now? I'm going to start cutting deals with all these dealerships.
Okay.
Your eyebrow raised when he said that.
Well, I think dealers are in a difficult spot. I agree there's some potential there, but what you just said all the opportunity for dealers, none of that was selling cars to consumers.
Correct. No, you're right.
And that's a very different business model.
And when I say dealers are in a good spot, it may be just to sell out, that there's going to be a demand for their property, you know, from not other developers, but by these fleets that are going to say, we want to provide ride sharing to all these communities around here.
But it's going to take a PSA to come in and without having, dealers could drag their feet to make, you know, for changes in the industry and how we get from A to B. But it's going to take somebody like a PSA to come in who doesn't have, and I don't, it's coming out the wrong way, but I can't think of a better word, but baggage that would be holding them back.
Right.
Not saying that about dealers in a bad way, but I mean, they just don't have that legacy issue to deal with, so that they're at a better advantage to do something like that as well in a different way. Yes, you could, but you can easily have just a warehouse somewhere that's just servicing cars. It doesn't have to be a fancy building with coffee shops anymore.
Right. So no, it will not be.
Right.
You're not
going to
want
to
pay primo real estate prices
on the side of some road or corner that, you know, is exactly premium real estate.
So serious question. I honestly don't know the answer to this. Who fixes semi trucks?
Fixes.
You're long haul.
No.
Yeah. I mean, is it the company that owns the service? Owns the?
They have
owns the fleet,
I believe, or certified repair facilities that are located near major freeways.
So it's not the dealer who sold you the Volvo or the Mack or the
because you might be
have
seven states away from there,
and you'll like pull off at a Pilot rest stop or whatever, and there'll be a repair guy, and you give him your fleet card, and that pays the bill for it. So
and he can fix it there.
Yeah, he can fix it there.
So isn't there the possibility that that could become the model rather than the dealership model?
Very possibly.
Yes.
Very possibly.
It's just the dealership, as you know it, is a, you know, this nice fancy building that has to meet all these brand standards, changes every 5 or 8 years or whatever, you know.
Right.
Those kind of things would probably
another billion be gone.
Right. Yeah. You know, invest in your Fiat studio.
Yeah.
Thing will be a thing of the past.
Driving around looking for parking. No.
If it happens. But I don't want to get into a car that, you know, the reason I bring it up is I've been reading about some of the things that people have, you know, example, Maven. One of the first cities they were in was Ann Arbor, where I live. And you read some of the things that have gone wrong that people, you're like, the gas card was missing out of the car. It was on fumes. I had to go right to the gas station. I had to use my own credit card. And I've been waiting 10 weeks for it to be reimbursed. There's a lot of things that I'm like, you know, that seem simple, but they haven't been fixed and are still going on. And I wonder, you know, do I trust somebody with baby seats or it comes in and I can't use it because, you know, baby had a blew up in it, you know, or whatever, before, you know, the car shows up in my house. Those are the kind of things that's like, you know, you got an emergency and need to go to the ER. You're sitting there waiting for a car to show up? How long, what do you do in the morning? You know, 3 a.m, your kid needs to go to the ER. What do you do? Those are the kind of things where I'm just like, I don't know.
This is why it's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight.
So,
but hey, look, we're running up against the end of the show, but we do have one more phone call, and somebody took the trouble to call us, so let's bring that phone call in.
Hi, John, Gary, and distinguished guests. This is Dale Leonard from Cleveland, Ohio. I have a question. I realize the take rate on manual transmissions in the United States is around 3%. What I don't understand is the rest of the world, the engineering is already done. In England, the take rate is at least 70 to 80%. Why, since if the engineering is already done, don't the manufacturers here let us special order or have a checkbox for a manual transmission? That's my question. Thank you, and wonderful show as always. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the question. It's a good question.
The reason is we are driven by our corporate average fuel economy. So what gets the best fuel economy? Your 8, 9, 10 speed automatic transmission, where it does the thinking for you and keeps you in the highest gear possible to get the best fuel economy. In Europe, those cars are taxed based on emissions, CO2, and that's, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if you're really what your transmission is, it's, you know, it's what you're going to put out. So That's, I think, part of the issue. You know, that being said, I mean, I know I'm driving a manual transmission car right now, but it's, you know, there is something to be said for some of the automatics now. They are just,
they've gotten good. They're so good.
And consumers have taken notice. So it's, but I think that's part of the reason, you know, why you see some of the discrepancy between here and there. And I think that gap's going to close, too.
I think it's just very simple that an automaker doesn't want to have to go through the cost of certifying the transmission and the engine.
Explain that a little bit, because a lot of people don't know that.
Well, so basically, to go to your point of basically being concerned with EPA and CAFE, so every setup that they have in terms of engine and transmission, they have to put through certification with the EPA to prove that that's the fuel efficiency that they're being.
It's a long process.
It's not cheap.
It's not cheap. Yeah, so you're spending all this money for, you know, small
for a
percentage.
Very small percentage. Small,
you know, yeah. So it's just like, you know, why spend the money? We could put in, you know, mats.
And the other problem is that as the volume drops on manuals here, the cost, you lose that cost advantage of what, you know, traditionally a manual had been the cheaper chicken, so per se. But now it's, as the volume has dropped in the last 20 years, it's not cheaper anymore.
It's like crank windows, that it got to the point where it was cheaper to put in power windows than to have part of the line getting crank windows, even though the crank windows are dirt cheap.
And that's a key point, I think, in all this. You know, so you're in Cleveland, and you say, hey, I want this manual transmission. And they go, oh, my God, okay, we spent the fortune to certify it. So now we'll get this one order. So you call up a ZF or an ISIN or whatever and say, hey, we need a manual transmission. They go, great, we'll ship you 50,000. You go, no, I only need one. They go, screw that. We're not selling you one. You can have a big block of these things.
Or we'll sell you them. Well, you know, you want 10 or whatever, you know, 1,000 a year. I mean, the price is going to be this, and it's not going to make any sense for you to buy it.
Right. And now I've got to put this in all my marketing material because people have got to know it's a special order. I've got to have spare parts at all my dealerships, even though they may never, ever see one of these things. So it sounds very easy to say the engineering's been done. Why can't I just special order it? The cost of doing that when there's a 3% take rate, if it's that, it's just cost prohibitive. And I'm a guy probably like you who called in who loves to drive a manual transmission, but they're disappearing for all the reasons.
But when you're spending 107 hours looking for a parking spot, you want
it's a lot of that. You're putting that clutch in too damn much.
Well, look, we got to wrap this up. Joanne Muller from Forbes, thanks so much for stopping by.
You bet.
Great having you here. Mm-hmm. Dave Sullivan from Auto Pacific, great having you.
Thank you.
Gary, let's do it again next week.
If I can find a place to park.
Okay. We'll make one for you. We're signing off, people. Thanks for tuning in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.